This is 89.9 WWNO. Yes, we're headed for another art-filled week. Are you making plans or do you need some ideas? Well, you've come to the right place. Whether you're in the mood for an evening of jazz or conversation with someone whose words were a guiding force in the nation's civil rights movement, it's all in the mixed media. Come along as we go inside the arts. Hi, I'm your host, Diane Mack. Wes Anderson is one of the finest alto saxophonists in jazz today. A member of Wynton Marsalis's great late 80s, early 90s septet and longtime featured artist with the Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra. Wes Anderson recently sat down with WWNO's Fred Kasten for a Talkin' Jazz interview at the old U.S. Mint.
Wes Anderson grew up in Brooklyn, son of a jazz drummer, surrounded by music and musicians.
Before I became a saxophonist, I was the drum roadie. I'd pick up my father's drums and take them. My father would do gigs around. And before I started playing, I used to see him do rehearsals at the house where he had a basement. And he had drums on there and piano and bass. So musicians were like uncles to me, uncles and aunts. They would come by, they'd rehearse. They were very friendly. They all had a certain personality that they talked with. As musicians, we have our own dialect that we talk about. So just as a young musician, I got a chance to hear the jazz music early. My father's brother, he used to work at a famous club in New York City called Birdland that was named after Charlie Parker. And then my aunt, she used to, they all used to go out. My father was the youngest of the three. So my aunt would, she used to love to dance, and they used to have a dance group called the Brooklyn Beboppers. And she used to dance with Charlie Parker. She loved Charlie Parker. Her favorite tune was Scrapple from the Apple, a tune made famous by Charlie Parker. And every holiday, everybody would come by the house, my mother would make food, and they'd have a couple of drinks, and then after that, then it would begin. So my aunt, she said, "Look, I don't need anybody to dance with. I'm gonna dance with the door." She would dance with the doorknob and show us, you know, how hip it was in the 50s and 60s growing up in New York. My family's mostly Caribbean. They're from Barbados. And I never got a chance to go to Barbados until I got older, started working with Wynton Marsalis. And I finally met some of my family down in Barbados. I didn't think anybody was still left. My grandmother, she's a talking accent. She said, "Boy, when you go down there, you're going to hear them. They're going to know you. They're going to look just like you. They're going to be big, and the women going to have arms and stuff look like you, and they look just like me." We finished a concert in Barbados, and there was two women that were talking. It was an outside concert, but it had like a big ledge. And these women just were talking. And I said, "Who they are?" They said, "You don't know me? I'm your aunt. Your grandmother called me, telling me you're coming." So that brought me closer to the Caribbean side of my family.
Is that your mother's or your father's?
That's my father's family. And so that was very interesting to see that later on in life. I was in my 20s working with Wynton. But growing up in Brooklyn, like I said, my father would always have rehearsals at the house, and eventually he said, "Okay, what instrument do you want to play?" I said, "Well, I don't know." So he brought a piano, an acoustic piano out that was a great piano. It was about this tall. It couldn't get down the basement because it was so big. But all the musicians would come and say, "Your father got you playing that piano, huh? I figured that. I know that." My father was very aggressive, so when we got the piano and he said, "Yeah, play this tune." I said, "Scrap from the Apple, the same tune." My aunt, like, I said, I don't know how to play it. He says, "Well, I'm going to play the music every day you come home from school, and you're going to figure out what to do."
Wes Anderson was 12 when his dad started him on piano, then took up clarinet at 13, switched to alto sax a year later.
When I was 17, I met the great Sonny Stitt. Now, this was unbelievable because he was the only person I heard at that time that was living that sounded like Charlie Parker. So to me, I said, "Well, this is Charlie Parker right here." So my dad would play with him. He would come and play for 2 weeks at a club. It's not there anymore, called the Blue Coronet. It used to be on Fuller Street and Nostrand Avenue. It was a famous jazz club, Monk, and a lot of people played in there. So he would come, and he's from what we call the old school musicians, where he was like my father, but even worse, like 10 times worse. So he says, "Where are all my youngsters?" So at the time, people who were very prominent now, we all were in there. Myself, Kenny Garrett, Vincent Herring. Yeah, Vincent Herring. We all were young. We all were teenagers. So he said, "I want you all lined up against the wall." He says, "I'm going to play Cherokee in all the keys." And he says, "I'm going to be listening. Y'all better not mess up." So we didn't really know, but we knew how great he was. So we get on there, and we were just like terrible. He said, next key. He would just go from one key to next key, and it's a very difficult tune.
Wes Anderson was just about to graduate from high school with plans to attend the Berklee School of Music that following fall, when a chance meeting with a New Orleans musician changed his life forever.
I saw a concert, an outside concert of Art Blakey with Wynton Marsalis and Branford Marsalis. At the time, I didn't know Wynton. Wynton was the newest thing hit New York City. Everybody's talking about him. But Branford at the time was playing alto saxophone. I went to the concert. A friend of my father's, another musician, his name is Cliff Lee. He is the uncle of the great director Spike Lee. And at this time, nobody knew who Spike was. But at that time, Cliff was so well known, him and Spike's father, they were brothers. They used to play a lot in Brooklyn, too. So Cliff was a good friend of my father. He said, "I'm going to take your son out and go see Art Blakey." So I went to see him. So we saw him, and I was like so amazed to see young musicians playing with Art Blakey. At that time, Art Blakey was probably early in his 60s or 70s. To see these young musicians play was like phenomenal. So it was outside. It was close to Harlem. So when we finished, Cliff took me to a club called Lickety Split. It was a small little tavern up in Harlem where they had a jam session. So he took me and he said, "Hey, you can come and learn." I'm playing, and I usually play with my eyes closed. So something told me, "You should open." Somebody is staring at you. Over my eyes, it was Branford Marsalis. I said, "Oh, my goodness." He said, no, keep playing. I like what you sound like. I said, "No, man." He said, "No." He said, "I'm going to talk to you when you finish." I said, "Oh, Lord, I got to hear this again." So we talked. I'm getting ready to graduate from high school. So Branford says, "Where are you from?" I said, "I'm from Brooklyn." He said, "You sound like the people I know down in New Orleans." I said, "I've heard of New Orleans. I don't know where it is." He says, "If you go to school, Gary, go to Berklee School of Music. I had a scholarship to go to Berklee." And Branford says, "Don't go there. You need to go study with the Baton." I said, "What's the Baton?" He said, "You don't know the Baton?" I said, "No." He said, "Man," he says, "my teacher." I said, "Oh, where is he? I want to study wherever you study. I don't care who he is." So we talked after that night, and he gave me all the information to call. This is Alvin Batiste.
Wes Anderson gave up his Berklee scholarship and enrolled at Southern University. His 4 years in Baton Rouge studying with Alvin Batiste proved pivotal. He made great strides musically under Alvin Batiste's guidance, met his wife, Desi, got deeply familiar with the New Orleans music scene, and began his long and ongoing professional relationship with Wynton Marsalis, Victor Goines, Herlin Riley, and a host of other great musicians. Wes and his wife are back in Louisiana, living in Baton Rouge, and he's making excellent progress in recovery from a major stroke he suffered last year. For 89.9 WWNO, I'm Fred Kansten.
Today's interview with Wes Anderson was made possible in part thanks to support from the New Orleans Jazz National Historical Park, which presents the Talkin' Jazz with Fred Kansten live interview series the final Friday afternoon of each month in the third floor auditorium of the old U.S. Mint. The series continues with Fred's interview of trumpeter Leroy Jones this Friday afternoon at 2. Wes Anderson and his quintet will play a pair of sets at Snug Harbor Sunday night, October 13th. You're listening to Inside the Arts on 89.9 WWNO, New Orleans Public Radio. I'm Diane Mack. He was a member of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s inner circle, speechwriter, political advisor, attorney, and friend, Clarence B. Jones, now a visiting professor at the University of San Francisco, a scholar and writer in residence at the Martin Luther King Jr. Research and Education Institute at Stanford University in Palo Alto, California. Dr. Jones will speak tonight at Dillard University. He joins me now. Welcome to Inside the Arts.
Yes, I'm pleased to be here.
As the nation commemorates the 50th anniversary of some of the pivotal moments in the civil rights movement, the 1963 March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, King's I Have a Dream speech, which you helped craft, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I'm often asked, how far have we come, so to speak, you know? The repetitive question, has Dr. King's dream been, quote, realized, close quote? You know, America today is significantly different than it was in 1963. From 1956 to April 4th, 1968, with the exception of Abraham Lincoln and the Emancipation Proclamation, Martin Luther King Jr. may have done more to achieve political, social justice, equal rights in America than any other person or event in the previous 400 years of the history of our country. When I go around the country and I speak, talking about the 50th anniversary and talking about the legacy of Martin Luther King Jr., one of the things I say as to why I do it, I think about that fable. If the surviving lions don't tell their stories, the hunters will get all the credit. Somebody says, well, who today, Professor Jones, do you think is most like Martin Luther King Jr.? I say, excuse me? Who today do you think is like Michelangelo or Beethoven or Mozart or Galileo? Nobody.
What would Dr. King, a drum major for peace, say about the violence in 21st century America?
I'd be less than candid if I didn't say that in some instances he would put his head in his lap and weep. He would say, hold on, my young black brothers, particularly, and sisters, what are we doing to ourselves? We are precious. Love is the answer. The Glock is not the answer. What is going on in this country for whom he worked and gave his life? That we are having young black men killing other young black men over nonsense, killing one another. Violence is not the answer. Violence is a form of self-extinction. We are better than this. Put down the gun. Put down the gun.
Will that be the crux of your speech tonight at Dillard?
I will talk about the legacy of Dr. King. I will paint a historical picture of where we were, and then I will contrast it to where we are today. And I will talk about the inevitable. We have got to take collective responsibility for ourselves.
Did you think that you, now in your eighth decade, would be a witness to yet another pivotal moment in this country's history with the election of America's first African-American president?
No, I did not think so. I was at the home of a faculty member when the networks announced that Senator Barack Obama had accumulated sufficient amount of electoral votes to be now declared President-elect Obama. So I'm in this room watching the results with 40 other people home, and people start to burst into tears, and I start to tear up too, and somebody said, well, Professor Jones, did you ever think you'd live long enough to see an African-American elected president? I said, no. And then they were about to ask me another question. I said, but my tears are not for the election of Barack Obama as president. So the person was taken aback a little. I said, my tears are for all of those persons that I personally knew who are not here, not alive, who made his election possible. That's who I'm crying for.
What must be done now to further King's dream?
To irrevocably forswear violence as an option to resolving a conflict and to commit oneself to the pursuit of personal excellence and the avoidance of personal conduct that creates adverse pathologies in our community. That's the way. You want to honor Dr. King. Be the best that you can be. Be the very best that you can be.
Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today. Dr. Clarence B. Jones, speechwriter, attorney, political advisor, and friend to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Dr. Jones is the co-author of What Would Martin Say? And Behind the Dream, the Making of the Speech That Transformed a Nation. Dr. Clarence B. Jones will speak tonight at Dillard University in the George's Auditorium, 7 p.m. The lecture is free and open to the public. Acclaimed Cuban-born jazz pianist and composer Roberto Fonseca, a rising star on the international music scene, is celebrating the release of his new CD, Yo, on the Concord Jazz label, touring the U.S. and making a rare stop in New Orleans. He joins us now by phone from the West Coast. Roberto, welcome to Inside the Arts, and congratulations on your new release.
Oh, thank you.
Tell me, what does the word yo mean?
Yo mean me or I. That's an expression, but we try to say that I'm share my music with the public, all the people that listen to my music. That's why I use the word yo, because it's completely me what I'm trying to do.
What was the inspiration for your new work?
I mean, the inspiration was my Afro-Cuban roots, because in this CD, we want to make a bridge between Afro-Cuban music and African music. I was exploring new sounds. I was trying to make a good balance between the vintage sounds with the modern sounds. That's why I use electronic instruments and acoustic instruments. And sometimes I'm using the electronics like a DJ's sounds too.
You incorporate many musical genres in your work. How do you describe it?
Well, for me, it's a really amazing experience. Because working with a lot of different musicians now, we're working with a lot of different sounds makers. That for me is a great, great experience. Because like that, I will develop my music. The music keep fresh. That's why I really like this kind of thing.
Now, you chose to record this one in Paris?
We decided to record in Paris because it was easier. Because if we want to have a special sound or a special instrument, there is easier to find people from Africa or from everywhere. You know.
Were you born into a musical family?
My mom was a dancer. Now she's a choir singer. My father was a drummer when he was a kid. And I have two brothers, Jesus and Emilio. They are a piano player and a drum player. I have a cousin, musician, and I have uncle, musician too.
Yeah. What was your first musical instrument?
Well, my first musical instrument was the drum. At age 4, I was trying to play drums, but then I switched on age 8 years old when I joined the classical music school in Cuba. My intention was to be a piano player.
What was it about the piano that you found attractive?
My parents, they told me the piano is the most complete instrument, and you can play drums on the piano too. You can play harmonies, rhythms. For me, it was really interesting.
What was your first musical job?
The first time was in the school. I was the drummer of that band. I was playing the song of the Beatles. It was like a Ringo Starr, you know. It was really funny, you know.
You guys thought you were the Beatles, did you say?
Yeah, it was Beatles, yeah.
And when did your big break come, professionally?
The big break was when I started to play with Buena Vista Social Club.
And this was under the direction of Ibrahim Ferrer?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it was with a group of Ibrahim Ferrer.
Yeah.
It was a really amazing experience for me.
What would you say is your musical mission?
I'm trying to bring peace. These days, there are a lot of confusion in this world, you know. There are many, many wrong things. We are trying to bring the peace and the smile on the face of the people. That's our mission. Yeah.
Peace and a smile.
Yes.
What can New Orleanians look forward to in your concert performance?
They will see a really crazy group of musicians because we really give our best on the show. We want people to enjoy the music. Sometimes we get crazy, but in a good way, you know. So it's going to be a lot of passion because, I mean, we are really deep into the music. It's like a movie, you know. We introduce the Afro-Cuban ambient. And then with that base, with that ambient, we will develop some stories, like the Latin jazz, and then sometimes we're going to be a bolero thing, and then sometimes we're going to be Afro blues too. But I'm a crazy guy, a really romantic guy that's trying to share the music with the people.
That's beautiful. I can hardly wait.
Thank you.
Roberto, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
Acclaimed Cuban jazz pianist and composer Roberto Fonseca will perform in New Orleans in a free jazz journey concert presented by the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Foundation, Tuesday, October 1st at the House of Blues, 225 Decatur Street, 8 p.m. The New Orleans band Los Pobrecitos opens. That's our show for this week. Inside the Arts is a production of WWNO. Our program is archived at wwno.org. I'll be back with more ideas for your artistic palette next Tuesday at 1 p.m. when we'll go inside the arts. I'm Diane Mack.